you're old. You're too old to be making these kinds of mistakes, these kinds of life decisions that are so drastic. And she said something along the lines of, you need to be comfortable with the fact that you might not meet someone your age, and you might meet someone who has kids. And how does that make you feel? And I said, you know, depending on the situation, I'm completely comfortable with that. So that was already baked into my system when my wife came into the picture.
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today, I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with raconteur and Renaissance man, Max Wassler. Max is senior director of brand and reputation for Meritz, the company that effectively created the incentives industry. From the gold watch to travel and loyalty programs, Meritz focuses on the science and art of people and potential. Prior to his work for Meritz, Max was founder of Riverco, a branding and marketing consultancy based in St. Louis, Missouri, where he contributed ideas, designs, photography, products, strategy, and writing for a client roster that included Basil Hayden's Bourbon, Gitman Brothers, J. Crew, Land's End, Patagonia, and Ralph Lauren. His work has been recognized by publications including Condé Nast Traveler, Dwell, Esquire, GQ, Men's Health, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. Max is stepdad to his two daughters, ages 11 and 8. In this episode, Max and I talk about the road trip when his hero father became a mortal man in his eyes. Max shares the three moronic moments, his words, not mine, that changed the course of his career and life forever. He offers a view into the first 6 months of stepfatherhood and explains how being a stepdad to preteen girls is like being a permanent freelancer with very discerning clients. We also talk about how Max's 38 jobs, ranging from swim product specialist to a reality show host to acting CMO for a digital publisher, have shaped and influenced his balance of full-time employment and free-time exploration.
I was excited to talk to you because I'm assuming I would be one of, if not the first, stepdad to talk to you, and a relatively new one at that. It's only been 6 months as their official stepfather and about a little over a year as I've participated in their lives as an impactful figure. So
let's start there with with your relationship to your dad or other father figures you might have had growing up. What was that like?
My dad was my hero. And I say it all the time. And I had a series on a blog about things my father taught me. And I had my friends and fellow dignitaries, right? Write about the things that their fathers taught them. And it could be everything from, you know, how to tie a tie to the fact that you can skimp on the fancy colognes for Old Spice and you can use that money to invest in Texaco, right? There were all kinds of wonderful lessons that came of that. But my dad was a dad early in his life, through no fault of his own. His father passed away when he was a senior in high school. And he had younger siblings for whom he was a father figure. And similar story with my mother. Her mother passed away from breast cancer at 11, and she had three younger siblings. I think my parents both bonded on that. In my mother's case, 11 years of age. In my father's case, 17, 18 years of age. He was a dad to two younger brothers and had to act the part far beyond his years. And so I was grateful my whole life that I had two people that screwed up a lot, you know, in the first 10, 15 years of parenthood before even having the children of their own. Yeah, my dad was the great provider. He showed no signs of weakness early, especially, and was the greatest champion of his kids. And my wife always says he has the kindest eyes. Yeah, he was just good at everything too. He worked at a hardware store when he was in high school, so he had this amazing set of tools that we would use on the weekends to do little, you know, Mr. Fix-It projects around the house. And to this day, I'm calling him and saying, like, I really can't figure out how to get this ratchet just right. And he's like, oh, you're using the wrong, you know, and it's even over the phone, he can fix a desk better than I can. And, you know, he showed us how to garden. He grew up and working summers on his aunt and uncle's farm. So we grew tomatoes in the backyard. And, you know, I learned about baseball from my dad, and I learned about the importance of a good can of beer. And, you know, and my dad really showed up when it came time to be a supportive parent. I can't recall a single event in my entire life that my dad wasn't present for. Like literally like every game. And when I think back on that, it's like, it's staggering, because I know that that's very rare. And so I feel super spoiled by the man that was my father. When I was 13, we had moved from a small town in Kansas to a big city in Missouri. I live in St. Louis, and we moved here because his company transferred him when I was 8 years old. But by the time I was 13, the company had gone through several changes in management, and they were in a position of downsizing and chose to forego the relationship with my dad. And I saw weakness. I saw him emburdened for the first time. And it was on a road trip that we took for a job interview for him and for a high school interview for me. They were wanting to place me in a Catholic high school in another town, that I really saw my dad as kind of fully formed, as more than just the hero that he was. And he bore a lot of himself to me at that time. And ever since then, our relationship has been that of one of understanding. There's a great lack of complacency. We actively participate in one another's lives, and he regularly provides me with the feedback that I need, you know, at the right time. It's wonderful. And I don't think I told you this, but the last Thursday, my dad fell off a ladder. I was at my kid's spring concert, and like the good boy that I am, I had turned off my mobile device, and my wife had not. And when we received the call from my brother on her phone, we didn't think much of it. And then we received two more calls from my brother and one from my sister-in-law. I left the theater and called them, and found out that my mother was frantic, driving to the hospital behind an ambulance. And for the next several hours, I sat with my mother and father in the ER. Thankfully, it was just a concussion and a bad cut. But yeah, there was about 30 minutes in the last week where I thought my dad died. And it was world shaping. I started thinking like, okay, so if this has happened, then these three things need to happen, and these four more things need to happen, and I need to call this person, and I need to get in touch with this person, and we need to start this plan and procedure. And I mentioned my brother. I'm the older of two, and like my stepkids, we're 3 years apart, and he's in another city. He lives on the East Coast. And so I do feel a great deal of responsibility for my folks, even though they're both in full control of their facilities and both still very happily married and clearly just the apple of one another's eyes some 40 years on. And I don't know. There's something to a dad, isn't there? There really is. He definitely did a number on me.
It sounds like it. I don't think everybody has that kind of story. You know, started off with my dad's my hero, and concluded with there wasn't an event in my life that he wasn't present for. Is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it really is.
What did he do for a living?
He continues to work to this day, but the job that got us to St. Louis, he was a stockbroker and eventually became a management trainee and trained other stockbrokers for a number of years. And now it runs investments for a local bank.
I see. How did his occupation, or maybe it was more his hobbies, influence your creative pursuits?
Yeah. So my dad was a fine arts major, and one of his first jobs out of college was drawing the fashion ads for a local department store in the small town of Quincy, Illinois, where he grew up. And, you know, he saw that responsibility at 17, that need to be the provider. He has a deep, well-built creative backbone that he instilled in me, and sat down with me with, I mean, we're talking about the computer printouts of the stock report that he'd bring home. And on the back side of that, he would give me drawing lessons. And my parents both saw in both of their kids a unique ability to express themselves. My brother is a phenomenal writer, has his law degree, and is now working for our government. And I was always able to express myself using a set of colored pencils and a well-tuned Pilot V5, still my favorite pen. My mother was very verbal and was a walking dictionary and thesaurus. You could ask her the definition of anything and she would have some understanding of language. And I think to have both brains, to have the sort of arts and sciences of my father, he was also very gifted in math. And then my mother was this very gifted, very fashionable Francophile with fashion management background. And she instilled in me, I mean, both of my parents were salespeople at the heart of it. And they taught me from a very early age that sales is not about the product, it's about the people. And that has been the message that I have brought to everything I've ever done in my entire life. So seeing that in my dad, and yeah, I can't say enough about him. That's, you know, to meet him is to love him.
Yeah. I'm curious, at some point though, he didn't go the...
Yeah, exactly. You know, the creative route.
Yeah, the creative route, and chose a life in finance, and I'm assuming something that he thought was more stable or lucrative. Do you know anything about that choice or pivot that he made? Was that before or after you were born?
It was before I was born, and it was entirely that. It was a responsibility. He felt an immense responsibility both to his immediate family, to his mother and his five siblings, and to his burgeoning family with his new wife. I think that she also sat him down and kind of read him the riot act. If you know anything about my family, you know that my mother wears the pants. And so he was like working in a framing business and trying to start a real estate business with his brother. And he was selling Campbell's soup cans to grocery stores. There were all these stories from how he was seeking something, but he wasn't sure what. And it took really the love of a good woman to put him in line. Now, I won't say that my dad's given up creative pursuits entirely. He just keeps them a lot closer to the vest than you or I do. He is a phenomenal painter and an incredibly gifted crafter. He's a patron of the arts. We'll say that. He was a board member and I think board president of a local artist guild and is a regular fixture on the local art scene here. So there's something to be said for that, I suppose, as well. I think he saw his path as something of a patron as opposed to a participant.
Yeah, that's interesting. The movement, the sort of different things he did while searching strikes me as particularly relevant to your own. You know, you mentioned you've had 38 jobs in as many years.
It's true.
It doesn't sound like he bounced around or you know, tried as many things as you have, but I'm curious about that too. It's not like, you know, it sounded like a lot of this movement happened before you were born, so it's not something you bared witness
right,
to, but
right.
That idea that you would try and try again and experiment and, you know, mash up different skills and passions.
That realization actually came out of a conversation with my dad. He called me one day, not too long ago, and he said, "Well, finally hit it." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" He said, "I spent half my career at the old job and I spent half my career at the new job now." And I'm like, "Well, congratulations, Dad." And I said, "You know, it's far cry from where I am sitting here at this age and having worked as many jobs in it as many years as I've lived." And he said, "Is that right?" And we kind of went down on a loose leaf piece of paper over the phone together. And sure enough, I had worked a job a year, which is wild to think about. But again, this is a testament to an early diagnosis of attention deficit disorder and a unique perspective on the world around me. I do feel like I was granted a lot of opportunity coming from the household that I did. One of the great things that my parents instilled in my brother and I early was the gift of travel and the gift of communicating with individuals far different from ourselves. Now, that's not to say that I have the widest swath of understanding of all walks of life. I certainly don't. But we were forced into a lot of situations while traveling with my dad, whether it was for work or for pleasure, to be around individuals our own age and have to like fend for ourselves. And I learned early that I have a lot of interests, that I'm uniquely saddled with a very deep and distinct passion for the entertainment industry, for fashion, for art, for food, and for even for like automotive pursuits and for the outdoors. And so I have been crafting or exploring different pieces of those interests in all of my career pursuits. And I've worked for companies in virtually all of those, except for I have never actually worked directly for a car company, but I have built many a vintage car. You know, so in those 38 jobs, the one through line there again is people. I always come back to the fact that as interested as I am in those subjects, in those areas of business or, you know, life pursuits, I'm more interested in the people that are pursuing those things. And I've been fortunate that I've had the opportunity to have some jobs that have allowed me to shine a light on those people. And so the results of years and years of putting together just this hodgepodge career has actually added up to a few different pursuits where it all made sense. So I've been lucky in that regard. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it does. And you know, we don't have to go over that same 38 job list, but I am curious. You said, you know, there's been a handful that have stood out or that you can point to and say, you know, like that's a really good definition of what I'm about or what I am capable of. And even in thinking through, you know, some of the different roles, positions, things that you've done, I was having a hard time putting a proper label on what it is that you do. Tell me if I'm characterizing this accurately. It is most often the marketing and positioning of tangible goods. Like it's not really like ideas and concepts and sort of campaign at that sort of higher order level. It's very tangible, like fashion, it is products, it is these, you know, things that you can touch and understand the quality and value of them. But I don't think of you as like a designer or...
I don't either. Really funny because I have to call myself that to the world outside of design so that they can get an insight into the process. There's, you know, heroes of mine that call themselves designers, but really what they are is curators that are able to express something that they then have a designer actually create. You're 100% correct. It is marketing or building stories around products and building products around stories. I am not just a storyteller, I am a story builder. And I very much feel if there is no authenticity in a product, I'm able to derive that authenticity through various means, whether it means actually imbuing it with authenticity, kind of divining it from user experiences. And I've been fortunate that the large majority of those tangible items are built well, are built with a lot of care and consideration. And so it's easy, it's so easy to say, this is something that you too can and should care about because it's visible, it's tangible, it's you put it in your hands, you put it in your body, you put it up to your face, you will understand, as I understand, that this is a good thing. So in the most general terms, I feel like having graduated with a degree in creative writing and then gone immediately into a role as a design consultant and then jumped from that into a role where I was working every night of the week behind a bar, you know, and then going into a graduate program in theater, I learned that all of those things make sense to me and to the world be damned, you know? And so it was very early in my adult life that the rails were really built for this kid that's going to have 38 jobs in 38 years. And boy, howdy, in those 38 jobs and in those 38 years, there have been so many failures. There have been so many experiences where I have felt like such a moron, but it's only from being a moron that you can further deepen the greater parts of yourself. And I definitely feel like somebody who is one failure away from his greatest success. That is a huge lesson in our household. the lessons learned in making mistakes. And you understand this inherently, and I think all designers understand this inherently, that the latest design is only the latest thing not to fail. And I want my kids to understand that screwing up on the field hockey field, screwing up on the lacrosse field, screwing up on their math homework is not the end of the world. It's the beginning of learning. It's where learning starts.
What are some of the critical pivots you just mentioned?
Sure.
That you think kind of moved you along from moron to, you know,
oh man,
brilliant curator of authentic things and stories.
So I was working for this catalog company early in my career, and I was working as like a design assistant. I was helping out as kind of like the utility man on the team. And I was an incredible vintage shopper, and I would wear these vintage clothes to work. And members of the design team where I clamored to actually be working, a different department from where I was, would take notice on occasion. And they'd say, hey, I love those boots. Where did you get those? And I'd see them at that place that I got them the next weekend or what have you. And the head of the department eventually came up to me and said, like, hey, bring me your book. And I didn't have a book. I wasn't, as you said, I'm not a designer inherently. And my young brain didn't think, go home and make a book. Had I done that, I think my life would look a lot different. And what ended up happening as a result was I stuck with the design assistant position, and that transferred into a production position where I learned how things are made. And learning how things were made bore in me ethic. And I understood the ethic of this company was not in line with my ethic for how things could and should be made. There was a lot of cutting corners to try to make profit at the expense of the end user. So I left. And I went to work for a company that I felt was more ethically in line with my understanding of myself. And that was a huge, huge education. And I'm proud to say that I was working retail and eventually worked as a visual merchandiser for Patagonia. And I wouldn't have had that experience had I just gone home and like made a book, right? So that was a huge thing that happened over the course of one night of my life that, looking back on, it's such happenstance and such kismet in the same instance. And so that's one. And then another really, really big one came about as a result of the encouragement of a boss to just start putting myself out there in blog form. I was working as an editor, and she said, in order to keep your mind fresh, why don't you also start writing about things that you care about? And the things that I cared about happened to be hitting the zeitgeist. And so my posts were getting picked up by much bigger entities. And it went from 10% of my time to 90% of my time writing that blog. And my boss took note, and she, you know, she pulled me into her office on a handful of times, and she said, you know, congratulations on all the success you're having with your new venture. But we kind of need you here. And so we amicably parted. Yeah, man. And then, you know, the other like massive blunder of my life was that I took a great leap and left a lucrative position in a city I loved, Chicago, to go to a part of the country that I knew very little about in order to be a support to a partner. So we packed up our things and headed for Los Angeles. And almost immediately upon arrival, it was clear that I had made a gross error. Relationship ended, whatever employment I had quickly dried up, and I was left completely besides myself. And if it weren't for some very caring and diligent friends, I don't know where I'd be today. They took me under their wing, and they provided me with shelter and with food. And I was able to kind of piece things together for myself for a little while until I realized it was time to pack up and regroup. And almost immediately upon regrouping at Thanksgiving 2 years ago, the world completely changed for me. And I moved back to my hometown, a place that I did everything I could to get away from because I don't fit in this town. It's not a town that celebrates people that have 38 jobs in 38 years. It's a town that is happy for you to have one job and work that job until the day you die. And I also was just kind of a loud mouth and very progressive and all too creative, I think, for this place. That's all changed, I've noticed, since I've returned here. And I'm very proud to say that I'm from here now. And it does have a creative heart beating beneath it. And I intended to leave immediately with good counsel from my little brother. I stayed. And within a week, I was consulting for a childhood friend on a business. And within 2 weeks, I was helping an old acquaintance in his restaurant. And within 3 weeks, I was madly in love with a woman. And it wasn't that fast, but it felt that fast. It felt like, wow, I haven't even made it to New Year and I'm already like totally set. It's hard to believe. It really is. So I don't know if that's answering your question about some major blunders in my life that have led to amazing things, but I'm in a very amazing place right now as a result of perhaps the biggest blunder of my life. So there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, all of those pivots. And those are just those are the handful of ones that you could recall because they had maybe the biggest impact, but I'm sure there were many along the way. Otherwise, how would you have navigated
all these? It's constant.
Yeah.
Antonio, isn't it constant in your life? Like, I feel like life is all about the choices that we make on a daily basis and how they net out. You can't even imagine. I know that's like science fiction and we're getting into Philip K. Dick and Ray Bradbury, but the reality is
cosmic triggers and things happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I exert a lot of energy in trying to tamp down the possibility of pivots. And I feel like you just like kind of flow between them and ricochet off of them and into the next thing. And, Are you
risk averse?
It's funny that the older I get, the less risk averse I am. I think I followed a pretty straightforward path. Knew I loved art and had parents that were supportive of that and took all the honors art classes you take in high school to build the portfolio you need to get to art school or design school. Visited SVA and applied to many others and just was like, New York sounds really intimidating and scary right now. And they don't even have like housing nearby. And so I'd have to like live across the city and commute in New York. Like, I can't do it. And I just freaked out. And I went with the Atlanta College of Art, which I don't regret, but it was also only like 40 minutes away from my folks. And so there was like a safety to that, right? And in school, identified pretty quickly that, design and advertising was a safer route than maybe other things that I had thought about, like illustration or things that, would have, again, meant less certainty maybe, and just kind of pathed up through agency and studio life. And I've made some big moves, like leaving jobs when I didn't have another one lined up. And to your point of like, I got to get out of this place. I don't like what they're doing ethically, those kinds of realizations. But I've never thought of myself as a risk taker or,
right.
a lot of the things that I...
Calculated as they are.
Maybe, yeah.
You do take risks, but yeah. you are sitting there with your TI-83 that is vacant of any cartel games or what have you. And you are going down to the very last decimal point, trying to figure out if this makes sense for Antonio. And I think that I do that, but I don't do it with the same analysis. The analysis that I do, it's feel, it's emotion. And that comes from perhaps my theatrical training that if it doesn't feel right in my gut, it's never going to feel right in my heart or in my brain. And I can't help but listen to the insides and understand what the insides are telling me. It's not so much about what society is telling me or what professors have told me. Although all of my professors told me like, you're going to be fine. Just keep being weird, just don't ever settle.
So you're making these moves.
Right.
And you
I always wanted to be a dad. Let's get back to that. Always wanted.
Well, I'm wondering.
Oh my God.
You move from LA home, this kind of like welcome back Cotter sort of thing, having bounced around and seen all these interesting
things. I had the Cotter mustache at the time too. let it be known.
I love it.
much to the chagrin of my wife.
And but then you get here and you're sort of like, oh man, here I am back home. Uh-huh. And then a really interesting series of events occurs, and within weeks, you're in love.
Yeah.
And and so when you originally had got me up to speed with things before this conversation, you had said that your now wife had brought her children to the restaurant.
Yes.
And so this was not a surprise that your wife had kids.
Right.
Most people who have kids from scratch, they have no visibility into what these kids are going to be like,
right,
what they're going to look like, how they're going to act, like nothing. You know, it's all up for grabs. It's all a mystery. And you just kind of roll with it. You know, you're in a position where you're meeting this person and her children, and you're getting a preview of these young women, her daughters, in a way that most parents they don't get to see that, right? There's no preview. There's just, you have them and you learn them. And so tell me what those early days as you're meeting her daughters and looking at this picture was like for you.
Sure. My parents, I was living with them, right? And I was driving a car that I bought from my mother for $1. and, you know, I was very much at their behest. I was living a fairly impoverished life as a result of making a lot of terrible decisions over the course of about a 2 or 3 year period. And the first conversation that I had with my mother that was a heart to heart was, "You're old. You're too old to be making these kinds of mistakes, these kinds of life decisions that are so drastic." And she said something along the lines of, "You need to be comfortable with the fact that you might not meet someone your age, and you might meet someone who has kids. And how does that make you feel?" And I said, "You know, depending on the situation, I'm completely comfortable with that." So that was already baked into my system when my wife came into the picture.
Oh, your mom is wise.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, who calls it like that? Holy cow.
She is. She hit the nail on the head. And this woman came into my life. And as she did, you know, it was so easy. She is so game where others had not been, and was so ready for the sort of bucking bronco experience of being in the orbit of my existence. And so when I first encountered her children, they were the spit and image of that woman who's just so game. And I say this to people that ask me or, you know, are blown away by the major transition. I wouldn't have done this for just anybody. They're really durable kids. They're really incredibly rugged. They function as almost more masculine than I do myself, which is a hard reality to face sometimes when they are better at a lot of the activities that I'm hoping to coach them in than I am. And I'm not talking just about sports, but genuinely just able to kind of fall down, pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and get back to whatever it is, whether it's a bully at school or it's a math problem that they're tearing their hair out about. They are incredibly gifted in that regard. And they are so warm and so welcoming and so loving to everyone they come into contact with. And I think it has something to do with the fact that they were raised by a woman who did everything she could to smooth the many transitions that they've experienced in their short lives through a divorce and through multiple households. And so to see how my wife is able to instill in these kids a good understanding of the world around them and provide them with a lot of perspective, it provides a lot of scope for very mature kids. They are wise beyond their years. And I'm rambling, but I hope that answers a bit of what you were asking.
You have. I mean, the idea of being able to see in advance what you will inherit as a parent, as a father,
is a gift.
Yeah, I came in at a great time. I didn't have to deal with poopy diapers. I didn't have to deal with bottle feeding. I didn't have to deal with learning to crawl, learning to walk. But the field is so vast still. And I said it as a joke to a mother that we are friends with the other night. It's like running through a minefield. We are up against it every single day. And the way that my wife handles all those minefields is mind-blowing. And so I am legitimately on her leash and following her lead and very comfortable in that role. But she will tell me all the time, you know, you taught them that. You know, you instilled that in them. You know, that was your idea. And to have that kind of partner it's a blessing, a big blessing.
Did you know that you wanted children before this relationship?
Before I could really fathom what it meant to be a dad, I knew I wanted to be a husband.
Really?
I've always known that. And the reality is that from a very young age, I was able to fall in love easily. And from a very young age, I was chasing the impossible, the person that was moving the goalposts on me. So in most of my relationships, I was the one who was like, let's do it. Let's go full bore. You know, they were always like, who is this person? Like, he seems a little too serious considering we're only 12, you know, we're only 14. It wasn't until the fallout of the last relationship where I was fully committed and I was comfortable expressing that to anyone willing to come within that orbit that I'm here 100% and I'll do whatever it takes to make this work, to have that all crumble and to do a lot of soul searching and a lot of time driving around in that $1 car, just thinking and also doing a ton of work in therapy. I blame therapy and I thank therapy and I'm grateful to therapy for educating me. And so unbeknownst to me, I landed in the exact relationship that I needed with the exact person that I needed at the exact time that I needed. And it happened fast and it was the right person. It was the person that was like, this is what I expect and you are meeting my expectations. And that had never happened in my entire life. Yeah, my whole life I've been told that what I provide or what I do is not enough. And there's a lot of anger in that. And I think that you probably have found this in talking to men of a certain age, that anger is a reality for us. And how I've dealt with the anger has been very unhealthy. And only recently have I been able to cop to that and actually begin to cope with it and begin to approach that which makes me angry and situations which make me angry and understand that anger and that frustration. And it's largely thanks to therapy and to having the right partner who is there coping with me, if that makes sense.
It does.
So a lot of what's happened since the last mistake of my life, right, has been just incredible success. Incredible success is I'm comfortable defining it as I feel like those who understand me and love me the most are able to see. That's been so incredibly rewarding to share that with this new family and to participate in that conversation in an honest and open way with an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old and my wife, that has brought us so close together in such a remarkable and exciting way. I feel like I'm ready to delve deeper into all of that and really piece it apart and understand it and keep what's good and eradicate what's bad. You know, as designers do, keep finding the latest iteration of self and of family and of meaning. And how to express that to the world around me.
You've alluded to 3 years of terrible decisions that got you to this point and,
right.
and dealing with suppressed anger and trying to understand yourself better through therapy. And then kind of in this, I would guess, sort of vulnerable point, like you've moved back home sort of, you know, hat in hand. You've got this sort of hard reset you've been presented with. You're kind of doing these different sorts of things that aren't probably which you're the most passionate about, but you know, you're getting your footing and figuring out what's next. And then you meet someone who you fall hard for, and they have, regardless if you want kids or not, they have an added layer of complexity in that there are now three people's lives that you are entering. And you could look at that from the outside and be like, no, Max, don't. Like, like pace yourself, pause, you know, get yourself in a more stable position, get things sturdy, and then go chase things. And maybe chase things that don't have, you know, young people attached to them. And instead, you did the opposite. Like, you went all in, which is a trait you've described having, but like at the risk of three people's lives, not just one. Tell me about that.
I didn't think about that. Antonio, great. Now,
tell me about, you know, the how would you characterize the emotions, conversations that you had, you know, impact on even your work? Like, okay, like, it's one thing to enter into a relationship with another adult. It's another thing to potentially become two people's dads. Well, I've never been a dad before, and they're already far along, and they're, you know, they're 8 and 11. Like, they're whole humans with their own preferences and perspectives, sure, on things. And like, I'm going to just insert myself here. Like, how, right, do you, like, what is stepdadness so far for you?
Oh man. The great thing about that exact situation is that there are three parents in their lives now. And as we remind the kids all the time, you get bonus love, you get bonus grandparents, you get bonus experiences, because we are a three income family. There's a great deal of responsibility that I felt well before I asked my wife on a date. And I went through that. I went through all of that very considerably, as we talked about before, heart, mind, gut, and a little bit of calculation, sure, financial calculation on like, what does this actually look like for someone like me to take on this responsibility to become one of three parents and then one of four full-time individuals living under the same roof. My wife made it really easy. She kept saying, you are exactly who I want these kids to learn from, and to see how you operate will show them that there are many ways to define life and to define a successful life. And so it wasn't until she was really getting to know me and expressing her enthusiasm for who I am at my base level that I even thought, oh, I'm good. You know, stripping away, as I did over the course of those 3 years of mistakes, all of the edifice of being this person who's a public person who talks about people who make things in America, or, you know, makes products that are rugged and durable and made for manly men, the brawny paper towel guy. I stripped all that away. And what I came to was like, I'm still good. I'm still trying to be a good man. I'm still trying to do everything I can for others. And despite the fact that I can barely do enough for myself, I was shown that through her enthusiasm for me, if that makes sense. And in so doing, approaching the relationship with the girls, our daughters, was easy, frankly. And at first, I will say, I wasn't sure how to step in, when to step in, where to step in. And it's only with a ton of trial and a ton of error that I've learned what that looks like, and what it looks like still changes, and it will probably change for an eternity as we continue to develop our relationships as individuals and as a family. And so I'm comfortable with that. And I'm comfortable with the knowledge that we are a three-parent household where all three parents are doing their level best to support in the ways that they know how. And as I've expressed to you, I'm very comfortable supporting emotionally, and I'm becoming more comfortable supporting financially. And the stepping in has become a lot easier as well, as I've learned that expressing myself to them has to come from a place where it's at their level and it's in language that they understand, and it's utilizing anecdotes and expressions they're comfortable with. So often I want to go through all of this Milton Ehrlichman therapy about realization of the self, the narrative therapy, and the understanding that, like, dragging your mechanical pencil across the hardwood floor is not going to make the math problem any easier. And it doesn't work. The thing that works is, okay, maybe we go on to the next problem and and then get a little confidence under your belt, and then you come back to the head scratcher. What I've found anyway is that with this particular child, all she needs is to fill her cup a little bit, her cup of confidence, and then she can do anything. And that's so special.
There's two things that you mentioned. Yeah. One is, how would your daughters characterize what it is their new dad does for
them? Oh my God.
Like, do they have words for
yeah,
it?
Did yeah.
You guys talk
yeah,
about
yeah, yeah,
it?
Yeah. They started to understand what I do when I brought home a rivet. I brought home from a business trip two rivets. And I said to them, this piece that you have in your hand, Ruby, and this piece that you have in your hand, Stella, are sutured together around a piece of aluminum that's bent around a frame to create a travel trailer. And holding those rivets in their hands, they said, this is why you drove to Ohio. And I was like, pretty much. Yeah, it was. And they were like, oh, okay. And then we sat down and we watched old episodes of Made Right Here. And they started to understand that I go to people who make things and I help them talk about it. And that's what I think that they would say. They also understand that occasionally I like to put my imprimatur on things that I'm particularly passionate about. So they've seen their stepfather wear something with his name in it or with his name on it, carrying things that I've personalized in some capacity. And I think that they understand that. And then they've seen, like, that travel trailer then turn into a branded piece for another business. And I think they understand that now as well, that it's branded content or brand partnership or bringing together like-minded corporations or individuals or what, or, you know, whatever the in-between is, to tell a greater story. And I think that that's been really instrumental in how they talk about design themselves. And what's wonderful is that we have an 8-year-old archaeologist and an 11-year-old rock journalist. She's ready for Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stone, 1972. You know, she is hardcore game for telling stories about the things that are happening in her headset. And Ruby designed a headpiece to look like King Tutankhamun's and, like, literally made it. And she designed a zip line for her dolls in her room. And she's designed parachutes for her stuffed animals out of old grocery store plastic bags. And the 11-year-old is starting to formulate pieces that are going to appear on a blog of her own impetus. This was her desire to do this. She's asking for input on design. She's asking to have input in how things come together. And I think that they see me as somebody who creates, I think.
It sounds like it. Do your children play any role in your creative endeavors yet?
100%. 100%.
What does that look like?
Well, I've definitely rethought the kinds of projects that I want to participate in and the kinds of work that I want to put out into the world. And I guess, you know, if you look back on it, all of the things that I've done are things that I hoped that my one day children would be proud of. But now more than ever, that decision is front of mind. And I cannot tell you how frequently my wife will say to me, this is something that you should show the girls, you know, something new that's come across my desk, something new that I'm able to participate in there. She will say, this is something you need to take because the girls are going to be so excited about it. The girls are going to want to see you do this. The girls are going to want to understand what this looks like. So yes, that is definitely always front of mind. It's nothing more complicated than that. Is this something that they would be into, proud of, happy to see?
I know you work on a combination of client work and personal work, and I'm curious, where does studio time fit into the mix these days?
The studio time that I allow myself went way up at the outset of this year. I held off on doing anything for profit, and it was a huge mistake. I thought that I would be able to self-motivate, self-create, and self-fulfill if given a 40-hour week to do so. Turns out that's not the case with me, that I actually need something to drive against. As an individual, that's where I thrive. I thrive in having a job and then having a side hustle. I didn't know that about myself in the way that I thought I did. So I didn't know that I actually love having a job. And from having a job, I'm able to create studio time, as you say. I'm able to create creative projects that scratch the itch, fulfill the need that I may not be getting from 9 to 5. And with regards to kids in the picture, the kids only enhance that. They are both critical thinkers, willing to sit with me and understand why I'm making this thing. And they're actually positing the actual need for the thing that I'm making. And that's imbuing in me the desire to further delve into that story around that product, and to further delve into the development of that product around the stories that they're helping me to create.
That yin and yang that you just described, let me make sure I'm characterizing correctly. We'll just call it like client and personal. Like the client-driven stuff pushes you into spaces that spark ideas for you personally. And making money off of a client-driven thing gives you some investment into your, you know, I can sort of Robin Hood theory, like I can take money from them and I can give it to these ideas that I have. But without paying client work, does the desire to make things kind of as an answer to the client work, does that kind of go away? Like just if someone just said, hey, work on your own things for a while, I feel like
which is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
My wife was like, this is your time to shine. Go do the things that you want to do.
But
and
do you lose momentum not having a client thing to sort of resist or to make work against?
I completely locked up after that moment. When my wife said, go do the thing you want to do, my self-esteem girders went way up. And I just started thinking, who am I? What am I doing? What does any of this matter to the world? Why does what I care about, who else is going to care about that in the capacity that I felt like I needed them to make it viable, either to myself or to the parties at hand? And it doesn't happen as much and the word I use is fulcrum. The fulcrum is the job, and all the things that pivot around the fulcrum are the expressions that I'm able to delve into and to find what is essential to me. So I have an inspiring day at work. I come home and I inject that into my side hustle. I have a bad day at work. I go into my side hustle with the intention of assuaging all of that badness. Client work is essential to me. It provides me with validity in a way that I didn't realize prior to not having client work and trying to work solely on personal work.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I think that dynamic, one feeding the other, or, you know, it's in the presence of one that you you can do the others. I think that's really interesting. And as I'm thinking through past interviews, I relate to what you just described a lot. And I think that the guys that I've been talking to besides you and I are like the opposite. Like they yeah. finally got to a point, like a breaking point where they're like, nope, no more of this client work. 100% all on my own terms, and they never look back, or they never did it in the first place. Like they just knew coming out of school or whatever, like there's no way I'm working for anybody. I'm doing this 100% for me, and this is, you know, I'm going to make a go at it. And I think and this is again going back to some of that like calculated risk, like there's something about having the client work there for me. And then not just like, oh, that's a steady paycheck or like I can count on it, but there's something like work, like it is always easier to work on and solve other people's problems. Always.
And that what you're saying has everything to do with the fact that there's so much fulfillment in setting aside the ego and just going for full gusto on whatever it is, because it doesn't have anything to do with me.
Yeah.
Ultimately. I put so much of myself into it naturally that at the end of the day, it is ultimately theirs and not mine. So be okay with that.
Yeah. What you just described, approaching something with less ego or without ego and kind of just embracing it for what it is and recognizing that it isn't about any one person, including, you know, yourself. Like kids are really good at reminding you.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and step kids especially, because we haven't had that moment where they say, well, you're not my real dad. But that's ultimately what the client relationship is. They're my clients, right? And what I find really fascinating as I'm like stepping into the role of the permanent freelancer in these kids' lives, it's a role I'm very comfortable with. It's a place where I live so happily. I didn't know that this is what I wanted until I got it. I didn't know that this is what I was going to be best at until it started happening. It's very much 100% effort on all fronts all the time. And I think we all feel very good about that, because the feedback has genuinely been, even when it's been really bad and really tough, it's been filled with understanding and love and compassion and the desire to learn from one another and with one another. So that's wild. I have never expressed it in that way ever. And now I don't know if I can ever express it in a different way. So thank you for that. That's an incredible insight into what has transpired here thus far.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. Really.
I joked.
I don't use the word amazing ever. So
I appreciate it. I think my wife and I, with our son had originally called him like the worst client, like babies. Babies are the worst clients, you know, because they're super demanding. They're really bad communicators. They interrupt your life and your flow at the worst times. They can usually tell you what they don't want, but can rarely tell you what they do. Like they're just awful little demanding clients. And that became like a really easy way to frame like the early days, like the bleak first 3 months of new parenting
yeah.
to anybody who didn't have a kid, but who had worked in like a creative space. I'm like, think of your worst client. And they're like, okay. I'm like, that's my baby. And they're like, no. And I'm like, yeah, you know, it's awful. But after 3 months, you know, you kind of climb up out of the earth and you're stronger for it. And things get a little easier. And, you know, I'll say to Maris all the time, like, man, you know, what if we could just fast forward through this particular phase or this season of our life to, you know, whatever, you know, pick a time that you imagine is better, like, you know, once our kids are, you know, not throwing tantrums, or once our kids are, you know, in school, once they're out of the house, once we're retired, you know, et cetera, like play them all out, you know, and that sort of fantasy to get you through the day. And I think about some threshold where the child wants to spend more time with friends or themselves and less time with the parent. And at some point that I think that happens for just about everybody developmentally. And I just imagine having two young people in your life that are closer, I think, to that threshold of independence than not is a really interesting dynamic. One, you're very right. Early in, but I'd still love your take and sort of how you see that impacting fatherhood. Ooh. And work.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot there. Let me start with, as you're talking about, as kids get older and they want to spend less and less time with their parents, and that's okay developmentally. Yes, our house is going through that as we speak. Both kids have iPhones, the result of being from a mixed family where there are three parents that they're in the care of at any given time. So we want to make sure that all three parents have the opportunity and ability to communicate with the kids. But the understanding at outset of the relationship with the iPhone was that it was for parental communication, not for peer communication. And in recent months, in a number of different circumstances, the 11-year-old has taken it upon herself to change that dynamic and change that understanding of the relationship with the phone. And how do you properly parent, around which there is no experiential learning within your own field of vision from your past? So we're dealing with it by eradicating it by and large. And at the same time, she has her first boyfriend. She is calling him her boyfriend. And it's very different from what I remember of boyfriends and girlfriends at the same age in my childhood. There are gifts every Friday. There is never a day where they do not ask, can we hang out with one another? And so to mitigate that as best we can, and to train up an 11-year-old young woman, right, trying to show her the way that it's wonderful that he cares for you in the way that he does. And he also, the circumstances are such that he's actually not going to be in St. Louis much longer. So there's that too. There's that aspect of let's soak up as much of one another as we can while we have the time, which I appreciate. And, you know, I think they both understand that there's no such thing as a long distance relationship at 11 years of age, hopefully. But she has a bicycle, newly minted bicycle as of Christmas. I want her to take that bicycle, and I want her to go to the candy store, and I want her to go to the tennis courts, and I want her to go to the pool this summer, and I want her to ride over to a friend's house and do stupid, silly things on her bicycle and skin her knees and fall down and get caught in the rain and hopefully have the bike stolen at some point so that we can tell her that's why you have a lock, you know, and all of the things that you want to do as a parent. You want your kid to, again, this is comes back to like the inherent knowledge that comes from failing a lot. I want her to have that. But at the same time, I don't want her to have to endure any of the unnecessary bullying that comes from being in constant contact with her tormentors. So I am coming into this at a time when the chains are starting to be loosened, if not broken completely, between parent and child. And child is being given more access and authority in what she does and where she goes and how she does it and with whom she does it. And I don't even want to get into what she wears, but that's also very much on the table right now. And it all boils down to they're going to grow up whether we want them to or not. So we're just letting her do it in the way that she feels comfortable and raising the red card or the yellow card or the white flag as the situation calls for, as we encounter it. And so I can't tell you how ready for this I was. I just felt it from a very early age, the desire to love and care for people younger than myself. I've always loved being a mentor. I've always loved having friends younger than myself. I've always advocated for the role and relationship of student teacher. There have been times where I did not feel like I was equal to the task, but I'm ready and willing to pick up the baton and lead this ragtag band filled with estrogen deep into the 21st century.
Yeah, man. I love it. This thing, the stepfatherhood you've committed to, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
thanks for giving me a glimpse into it this early on, you know, when things are still male formed and taking shape. And
yes, very much.
It's cool to see, you know, to see you in it and to hear about it now. And I'm sure.
Oh, it's still very much. We are still very much a lump of coal, just praying that it's a diamond inside of there, you know.
Yeah.
it's fantastic. And I can't tell you how grateful I am to you and to anyone who encounters this for taking the time to listen to me and to actually engage with me on this. It feels so powerful and so meaningful, and I will cherish this for a long, long time. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell Podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a review on iTunes. As a new podcast, this helps a ton and would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks, so visit dadwell.co to find links to all of those. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter, check out some helpful resources and books, and even cop some fresh Dadwell merchandise. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.